They say cash is king, and maybe that's true, but plenty of people are watching the stock and bond markets very carefully today. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning on Central Standard, we'll be convening a timely money therapy session about how investors and their advisors have been handling the recent market peaks and the even more recent market volatility. Last week, a fear index measuring investor uncertainty rose to the highest levels since the 2012 euro crisis. Stock futures were edging up as markets opened this morning, but that follows a week when the Dow Jones Industrial Average erased all its gains for the entire year. So how are you feeling? Want to talk about it? Join the conversation after this news. When the markets close at the end of the day, if you're tuned to Marketplace, you either hear this, or this. And you probably feel about the same way. Both U.S. and international stock markets have set their all-time highs this year, and an August 30th article in the Wall Street Journal assured readers that although there were risks to watch, fund managers and investment strategists saw little on the horizon to knock markets off track. If the stock market were a movie, what happened next would have been totally predictable, because when things look really good in fiction, that's usually a setup for a devastating turn of events. But in real life, stability seems like a halfway reasonable prospect, so people were surprised last week when the highs in the summer market took fall a bit too literally. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Central Standard's Money Therapists. They're going to talk us through the ups and downs. Our question today is whether we handle peaks in the markets differently post-recession than we used to. And if we don't, is this week making us wish we did? We want to hear from you at 816-235-2888. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Money Therapists, introduce yourselves.
I'm David Jackson, a financial advisor with Waddell & Reed.
I'm Lucas Butchel, a certified financial planner from KHC Wealth Management.
Yes, Alex Petrovic, Petrovic Financial Services, and as well, all three of us here are CFPs and representing the local FPA chapter.
That's right. All of our money therapy regulars join us from the Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City. So, guys, this show originally was formulated to be what you do when the markets are up. We had a decent amount of confidence that we'd be sitting here today talking about a market that's up. Why did we have so much confidence?
Well, I think it's one of those things that people remember what's happened recently. So we've had a really nice long run of generally positive returns, and human nature says that's going to continue into the future.
Human nature says it. Did anyone else say it?
Well, I think lots of people were speculating that the markets had room to run and lots of things were going positive. So absolutely.
So when markets were rallying and things were looking good, not just as a fluke, but over time it was staying that way, did you see clients expressing more reluctance to dive in headfirst than you tended to see before the losses of the recession?
Actually, I would say it would be just the opposite, you know, and it's kind of counterintuitive. But when the average investor sees the market going up, they think, you know, now's a great time to get in. When we try to school our clients that, you know, you buy low, sell high. But, when people see the market going up, it's like, hey, I want to get some of that, too.
So is human nature just exactly, does it tend to run counter to what investment wisdom would dictate?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, the old, you know, axiom, the fear and greed. So recently, it's been greed. I've missed out on this 150% rise off the lows of the 09 area. And so you get greedy, and you tend to be more confident at that time. And when markets are selling off like they were, in March of 09, people get very fearful and they don't want to take advantage of maybe much more attractive prices. So, yeah, human nature and emotions, boy, it is at odds with long-term investing.
Well, I'll acknowledge my own bias here. I'm more well-versed in history than in finance. Add to that an extremely risk-averse personality, as in I don't think you could get more risk-averse than I am. And I would say you have a recipe for not trusting in anything that looks too good. Are you seeing people like me, or does optimism tend to accompany these peaks for the average investor? I feel like I'm hearing you saying optimism reigns supreme.
I would say that we see both, though, because a lot of people still cannot get the 08, 09 out of their minds. I have my son that's a partner with me. He's late 30s. He's been in business around 10 years. He's never seen really what he's – a confident bull market that lasts. So he has a much more different perspective on risk of how to make money in the markets. I mean, he's a very smart kid, but his experience – of late has not been that positive. So,
and his experience of late has been the bulk of his professional experience. I mean, do you think age affects how people have experienced 08, 09?
Oh, I think so. I think there's a lot being written right now, and I've seen it with folks that we talk to in our office about the younger generation, millennials, and even folks that are just above the millennial area being more risk averse and potentially to their detriment. Because of the experiences they've had. So, you know, give myself, for example, in my middle 30s, my first investing experience was coming through the 2000 tech bubble bursting. And then we had another major market crisis in 2008 and 9. So most of my adult life has been talking about tumultuous markets.
And that's what bubbles do, right? I mean, you never hear anyone talk about a bubble that does anything other than bursting.
Eventually. You know, so it's interesting. You think about the gray-haired guys here at the table, Alex and I. And so we experienced the 1990s where the market just went up on a tear. And so we still have that mentality of, okay, it's going to come back. But your generation, you know, to Lucas's point, your generation hasn't seen that prolonged growth in markets. So you are a little bit leery. It's like, oh, does this stuff really work?
Well, I'm looking at this in index of investor uncertainty and fear, and it's showing the highest levels since the 2012 euro crisis, though it hasn't climbed back to the Arab Spring levels of 2011. But is what happened last week really worse than, say, annually teetering on the edge of a fiscal cliff?
No, I don't think so. I think what happened last week and really over the last month is very normal. It's a very classic traditional market correction. You know, it's something that just is part of investing. So as an investor in stocks, especially, you have to be ready for those ups and downs. And this happens regularly. So I think it just hasn't happened in a little while. And you know, people – It kind of conjures up those memories of worse times, like Alex had mentioned. But this is very normal and should not be alarming, although people will experience that for sure.
I agree with Lucas. This is a far different time frame, I believe, than the 08-09 is, at least we hope so, because 08-09 was a historical credit crisis. It wasn't a stock market drop. I mean, the stock market dropped because of the credit crisis. Whether you like how this was mended or not, with the Federal Reserve basically giving the banks money, it's worked. And the banks are far stronger, obviously, than they were in 08-09, which is a good thing because we need banks no matter what you know, you think of the process. We need a healthy banking system. The banking system is far healthier now than it was.
Why do we need banks?
Well, because it's pretty hard to trade eggs and, you know, chickens, you know. We have a way to execute the transfer of money and assets. And you know, a lot of people want to say, well, I'm going to buy gold. And I always say, if you buy gold, buy very small nuggets. Because how do you get change from a gold bar if you want a loaf of bread or a dozen eggs?
Something in what Lucas just said kind of interests me, which is that you shouldn't invest if you can't weather these kinds of the dips. And
absolutely.
One of the things that was often discussed in 08-09 was that people had become complacent and were treating investing in the markets as a way of saving or accruing wealth, that was the attitude toward it, that you couldn't really lose. Do you think that people have been disabused of that idea fully, or do you think you still see some of that there's an expectation that when someone says now's a good time that it's quote-unquote safe?
You know, I would say the average investor, and you know, I use average liberally, but the average investor still feels the pain and senses the pain of 2008-2009 and losing that type of money. And so as they invest going forward, that thought of, well, you know, I really could take a big drop again, let's try to protect at least some of our money, still comes into play. That's part of most people's thinking still.
You know, there are all these measures of fear among investors. CNN does a fear and greed index with the little meter, like a gas meter, you know, and if it's toward the what would be empty on the gas meter, you have extreme fear. And then on where it would be full, you have extreme greed. Right now, it's pointing to extreme fear. And that's despite equities posting a comeback on Friday. Does a shakeup scare people no matter where things land?
Yeah, I would say so. And, you know, but the bigger picture is, in 2013, we had kind of a record-setting stock market run. I mean, it was the best year we'd had in quite a while. So a lot of the so-called experts have been anticipating there'd be some kind of correction coming off of that. So this is really not a surprise to financial professionals, but to the average investor, anytime they're seeing their accounts going down, they're like, well, how long does this last? You know, where is the bottom? And they get fearful.
If it's not a surprise to you, does that affect how you counsel and advise people? Do you try to prepare people for that?
I had a client that called me on Thursday or Friday, and, you know, he just basically had been watching the news and said, Dave, so what's going on with the market? I thought, it's nothing that was unexpected. So, you know, I think we'll weather this pretty good. And he said, oh, thank you. And he was just fine, you know.
I think that's one of the things we focus on with our clients, especially new clients, but also reminding our existing clients is that, you know, markets go down from time to time. And if you're having any significant amount of money in stocks, you have to be ready for that and know that when it happens, it's normal. And the more importantly is that it's really important then to stick to your strategy. So when we design a strategy for folks, the intent then is to, when we have these ups and downs in the different markets, is to periodically rebalance. And what that does is it forces you to sell your winners at good prices and buy your losers at low prices, which is exactly what you want to do, right? Buy low and sell high.
Right.
But
you want to not freak out.
Exactly. But if you can stick to that disciplined strategy, you know, it sets you up to do really well. But when we talk about you know, the overall strategy, it's really important to focus on the downside and say, okay, you know, here's the returns based on history that you can experience with this portfolio. If you can't hold your water on the downside, then this is probably too aggressive for you.
Yeah, I think, and all of us here are both investment managers and financial planners. And there's two pieces there. So after the 2009 bottom, you know, we asked our clients to come in. Of course, they wanted to come in. And we said, okay, can we still reach our goals from right here? And that's the most important question is, you know, for most people that have money, usually they're older. And their biggest fear is living, you know, their money running out before they die. So the real question is, what I have and what I'm doing, is it going to get me to the finish line? And that's where you should start. And then what you do with your money to get to the finish line is the second part of it.
But that is so scary because none of us know where the finish line is. I mean, you could live to be like 103.
A lot of moving parts.
Yeah. But, you know, planning would be easy if we knew.
Yeah, and really there are other risks that, you know, the media wants to talk about all about losing money, fear and greed, or making money, fear and greed. The real question should be, you know, is living too long and not being able to purchase because inflation risk and longevity risk, which really neither of them are really risks. They're stark realities. You're going to get older. We're living older because of medicine, and everything goes up in terms of purchasing price. So really, we need to refocus on other parts of risk. So, and I'm getting a little windy, but you can only do two things with your money, which is you can loan it to somebody or you can buy something. And so loaning it is bonds, and ownership is stocks or a business or real estate, you know, and so forth. So you have to make those determinations of what risk you'll take and where the most bang is for your money over your lifetime.
So these measures that we've been talking about that measure investors' state of mind, are there more of these than there used to be, or have we always measured our psyche alongside the numbers?
Oh, I think there's definitely more than there used to be. I hadn't heard of the CNN one until you brought it up earlier, so that's a new one to me. I think that's the volatility element and kind of this extreme element is more of a recent phenomenon, and I think it plays really well on cable news. And I think it kind of gets people lathered up, and generally I think it's a bad thing for most folks to spend too much time looking at or thinking about that.
Or treating fear as a measure of something that's real.
Exactly. Because that's the idea, right, is that they want the eyeballs to stay there and you kind of have to hit the extremes to keep that. But the reality is, sticking to a strategy and thinking long term, I think what a lot of these measures do is they get you focused on the short term. And really, that's probably not the most important thing to be thinking about. It's what's the long-term plan? What are your long-term objectives? And what are you really trying to accomplish with your investments?
But with people's fear being measured in this way, we do have to acknowledge that people are like suffering emotionally deep down when this stuff happens. Why do we do this to ourselves? Is there something about handling our money in this way that makes good sense, even though it's so tumultuous and unpredictable?
Well, here's the real rub that I think we deal with as financial planners. So investment experience is one thing. Investor behavior is another. So I was reading an article over the weekend that talked about the S&P 500, or the market, over the last 20 years has averaged around 9% returns per year. And then they took the average investor and what were their actual returns during that same period of time. The average returns were about 5%. And it's because of this fear and greed that Alex was talking about. People get in at the wrong time, they get out at the wrong time, and they lose about half their potential returns because of what they're doing emotionally.
This money therapy session on Central Standard will be right back after a short break. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us how you feel about market highs and market lows, and whether you invest based on your feelings or something else. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a sec. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with financial advisors Lucas Butchell, David Jackson, and Alex Petrovic. They're our money therapists here on Central Standard, and they're coaching us through market highs and lows. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. That number again is 816-235-2888. And let's go ahead and talk about the current environment in a little more detail, because the last week has gotten the attention of people who were maybe kind of not paying so much attention for a little while there. Alex, want to start us off?
Well, you know, the markets aren't particularly cheap. They're not particularly expensive. They're somewhere in between. If you look at historical measures of how we evaluate, let's say, the S&P 500 in America, the American markets have been more stable, the USA markets, because our Federal Reserve really reacted very quickly and efficiently, it appears, as opposed to what was done vis-a-vis in Europe. And they're kind of lagging. So our markets have been far more attractive. At some point, because of the over maybe participation in our markets may get a little expensive, and then the foreign markets are going to look cheaper, and that money will rotate. It follows valuation overall. So right now, I think it's, you know, people need to be thinking long term. And lastly, you know, today's at the end of the day, Apple's going to record their quarterly earnings. We are so fixated on quarterly reports, which makes everything look so short term, as opposed to problems that you're trying to solve are much longer term, which is your children's education, you know, your retirement and so forth. So can't say enough. You got to think long term.
Though, just devil's advocate here, if you aren't paying attention to those incremental shifts, are you possibly setting yourself up to be, you know, caught off guard by changes that you could have seen coming if you were paying attention to these short-term progressive changes?
Well, sure. Absolutely. That isn't to discount, you know, the fact that we're not riding in buggies anymore, and buggy whips aren't the place to be. You know, it's cars. But long term, I think we have to think more long term because we're so centric on short term.
So we have some self correcting to do in terms of our pacing and our longevity of vision.
Correct.
Anything else about the current market that you want to draw our attention to?
Well, I think the current economy is, you know, the U.S. generally speaking is improving. It's healing up. Unemployment's down. GDP growth is tepid, not at levels we'd love to see. But hey, we're a growing economy. Everything seems to be moving in the right direction. The stock market really reacted last year and previous years, and I think the valuations maybe got a little bit ahead of where our recovery was. And so a natural pullback in the U.S. markets would be expected. Internationally, which is also really influencing what's going on today, is what's going on in Europe. There's been some, you know, bad news coming out of Europe just in terms of what their economy as a zone is doing with Germany. potentially having negative GDP growth for the first time in a little while. So, I think there's just been growth concerns about what's going on in Europe, which kind of bleeds over to other places because of our interconnected economy anymore. But I think, I think it's just a realization that, wow, we've come a long way. And, maybe there's just a little bit of correction that needed to happen. I think you've seen that over the last couple of weeks.
Well, and I also would like to just chime in that the average investor feels when something happens in the news that affects the market, they need to do something. They just feel compelled to, okay, I need to make a change to react to what's going on. When in most cases, the best thing to do is just sit still. You know, that's for most people, most of the time, just sit still, because if you set your portfolio up, your investments up for a specific goal based on a specific time frame, the short-term stuff is going to go away. You know,
that applies to so many kinds of situations. Do you think that just that need to feel like you're in control and you're active?
That's absolutely it.
Do you think that there's some sort of fear that if you're not paying attention and responding, that you're being negligent?
Yeah, there is. And I think that's, kind of why we're here, is because we promote the idea of financial planning. And people with financial planners, generally speaking, we'll have somebody to talk to bounce these ideas off of. Okay, so gas prices went down. What does that mean to me, and how should I react? And a lot of times when you have somebody to talk to, it'll keep you from making just wild decisions.
I find that to be the case. Let's talk to Greg in Kansas City. Hi, Greg.
Hi, guys. I was just kind of curious. I'm a pretty avid investor, and I get frustrated when I feel like that huge market swings are happening because of huge buying and selling from hedge funds, mutual funds, and that the investor like myself are the ones that get hurt, because I don't know when it's going to go up or down, but they seem to manipulate that.
Who wants to take this question on?
I'll take it. I mean, I think the concept of, what's driving the fluctuations in the markets, and then ultimately what you're going to do about it. I mean, I think I'm more of a traditional investor when it says let's buy, let's invest, and let's be disciplined about it. So the big swings in the market actually provide you opportunities to buy things that are out of favor and sell things that maybe have gotten overpriced. So I view the volatility as actually a good thing. If you're trying to time the market, which is more speculating than investing, in my opinion, then I think the unpredictability of it does cause you a problem.
So that is an interesting distinction, though, between what is healthy for the economy and what is healthy for the what is good news for the investor.
Absolutely. I think there's a disconnect oftentimes between economics and the stock market. And that's one thing that I think is easy to get blurred, both by the media, but also by investors.
In answering Greg's question, I think it's appropriate, but hedge funds make mistakes too. They make big mistakes.
Yes,
they don't have the first right on accuracy. So I wouldn't be that concerned what hedge funds are doing, because they do at times, make a market move up or down.
Yes.
But long term, we're all in the same game. And which is to make money over a long period, and hedge funds don't always get it right.
So this idea about the past year that we've had stock levels reaching all-time highs, it's hard to understand from the outside what caused that. I mean, what is it about the economy that created those highs in the first place that we saw recently?
Well, one of the interesting things when you think about the stock market, you have to think people are thinking forward. They're thinking, what's going to happen? And so people who are investing are thinking, okay, is the economy getting better, and how is that going to impact businesses and company profits going forward? And so the stock market run-up last year was based on people thinking, yeah, I think the economy in 2014 is going to be better. And if we look at the GDP for the third quarter, it looks like it's going to be better. I mean, it is better. So, that's constantly, and that's kind of the mistake that an average investor will make, is they will make their investment decisions based on what happened. And we'll give you a perfect example. I had a client that came in for a review about 3 weeks ago, and he came in, no, actually it was about 3 months ago, and he came in with a sheet showing all the areas of the economy that had gone up so far this year, and he wanted to make his investment decisions based on what had happened.
And then,
but it's too late to benefit from that.
Exactly. So we had another review about 2 weeks ago, and he said, that was kind of dumb on my part. David, I'll listen to you from now on.
So you're having a great I told you so moment.
Yeah, I didn't say it, but, you know, the thought was there.
Let's talk to Rick in Liberty. Hi, Rick.
Hey, yeah, I wanted to say a couple of things. First, the most recent correction, you know, I knew it was a possibility, whatever. My reaction was to change my 401k deduction from 15% to the maximum 35%, because when it's down, that's the time to buy. And then my question is, can you really beat the market and pay yourself effectively? And the reason I ask that is, about 20 years ago, I was really into watching everything and moving the funds around in my 401k constantly based on what I thought was going to happen. But I actually kept a log for a year, and I eventually figured out that the difference, that I did manage to beat the market a little, but the amount of time that I spent, I ended up paying myself about $1.27 an hour. So do you want to pay yourself $1.27 an hour just to beat the market?
Huh. Okay. So who can take on this question? I've got a lot of smiling faces looking knowingly at one another.
Well, I think he hit one thing on the head was buying monthly. You know, we buy our cars that way. Mostly we buy our homes that way. If you consistently buy in up and down markets, you're going to, you know, history has said, it's not a guarantee, but historically it's shown that you are going to make money. But you have to buy when the market's down as well as it's up. So the clear advantage for people that are, you know, working now that can save money in their 401s or wherever is buy, and don't stop. And you're building, you know, equity in your home that way as well as your cars, and the market is the same thing. So he hits it on the head, is continue to buy.
And especially if you do what he suggested, the market's down, so I'm going to increase my contributions into the 401k. Buy low, you know, over time. Yeah, he's going to come out ahead doing that.
All right, let's go and talk to Gloria in the Northland. Hi, Gloria.
Hi. Well, this relates to thinking forward. I was listening to NPR.
Good.
One time, and I heard a story about a woman in an undeveloped country who was selling Avon products by traveling by canoe, a homemade canoe, up a creek. And I think to myself, oh, Avon's going international. And so I bought some Avon stock without my financial planner's advice. And over time, it has done well, and that's a fund that I now make charitable contributions from because it has grown. So I call that buying by instinct and NPR.
Well, so hearing a news item that isn't especially intended to be treated as investment advice, and taking that nugget and taking a risk based on that nugget, it seems to have worked for Gloria. What do you all think about that? I know you might not be thrilled that she did not consult her planner.
But, you know, sometimes it can work. You know, one of the things Warren Buffett has always stressed is invest in things that you understand, as opposed to, you know, during the dot-com boom years, he didn't get into technology stocks because he didn't understand them. He stuck with the tried and true, real solid company. So, I mean, I can see the logic in investing in something that you believe in and something that you use.
There's still time to get your 2 cents in on this money therapy session. Call 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. You're listening to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with the Money Therapy crew. Money therapists, could you reintroduce yourselves?
Alex Petrovic, Petrovic Financial.
Lucas Butchell from KHC Wealth Management.
Yeah, and I'm David Jackson with Waddell & Reed.
They all join us from the Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're talking about whether we handle the ups and downs of the stock and bond markets differently in this post-recession era, wizened by our collective losses, or if the game has stayed essentially the same. Art, we've talked a little bit about the past year and then in the context of the past year, the past week, and something that we haven't discussed yet in looking at that is what they call the 10-year T-note.
10-year Treasury. It's kind of now the benchmark bond index in our country. For many years, it was a 30-year bond. So the 10-year is, in modern history, it's lowest that we've seen, you know, again, in 50 years or so. It even went below 2% here recently, which is about 200 basis points or 2% higher than it is over in Europe. But the 10-year bond is our kind of our benchmark, and it's a reflection right now of some fear and a slow global economy.
What does that mean? I mean, what does it mean when we talk about the 10-year T-note and it's changed from 30 to 10, what does that mean and why did it happen?
Well, I'm not sure why the benchmark went from 30 to 10, but currently the 10-year is traditionally it might be in the 5 to 6% range, which also mean that you might be getting 3 to 4% on your CDs. So now at historic lows of around, let's say, 2 to 2.5, and your CDs are basically zero. So it's the investors globally seeing a slow growth, and our U.S. Treasury is the currency of the world still. It's the most, you know, favored currency of all other currencies out there. So it gets a lot of play and recognition and attention, and rightly so, because we're a great global growth and have one of the best rules of law.
So how much stock, if you will, should we put in reports on how the 10-year T-note is doing?
I think what it really is, that's the rate that the government, U.S. government, can borrow money for 10 years. But what it really means when we're talking about that as a bellwether is it's a kind of an indication of market interest rates. And that's really what you're looking at is the movement of interest rates in the market, which tend to tie off of or be related to the 10-year Treasury note. And so what I think when you say the 10-year T-note's down to, you know, 2% or whatever, what you're saying is market interest rates are really low right now compared to history. And what that signals is something that's really important for the bond investor. So when interest rates rise, bond prices go down. So there's an inverse relationship between the price of a bond and the direction of interest rates. And so the concern would be as a bond investor, if interest rates are historical lows or close to, it feels like there's probably one direction that they can go.
Only one way they can go.
And there might be some more risk to you as a bond investor. And so what does that mean and how does that change your investment view, I think, is really what you're getting at.
The risk of bond investment has always confused me a little bit because my understanding of it, which must be incorrect, but it is that it is sort of if you wait the allotted time, there is a certain level of guarantee or fixed return on investment. So where does the risk come from?
Well, most people do not hold their bonds to that maturity that you're talking about. So if a person purchases a 30-year bond, it's unlikely that they're going to keep it for the entire 30 years. So during that 30-year period, what happens to it? Does the value of it go up when you're ready to trade it, or does it go down? So bonds do fluctuate, not nearly as much as stocks do generally. So stocks can be pretty volatile. Bonds are a lot more steady as she goes, but they do move, you know, and with interest rates being as low as they are, and as Lucas mentioned, the likelihood is that interest rates will start going up. There is that concern. What will that do to the bond prices over time?
But so it's the way people treat their bonds that makes them similar to stocks more than the bonds themselves?
Well, if you do hold the bond to maturity, you're going to get your principal back. Just as importantly, though, is the purchasing power of that bond. So buying bonds now at 2%, and if we all believe that, you know, that inflation will still be with us in our future, which I totally do. So it's really not just so much losing money on the bond because it will mature at maturity. Most bonds do at face value. But it's the purchasing power, and I think that's what Lucas is also, you know, relating to is that, boy, that's historically, If history plays out, this is not a very good time to be buying bonds because you're buying them at really low rates, interest rate, which means the prices are historically high, and it's going to be hard to make money in bonds. That doesn't mean you're going to lose money, but the expectations have to be lowered. We're not going to make the easy money in bonds that we did the last 30 years. You'll make money, but it's going to be lower.
So let's talk a little bit more about expectations. Are there any aspects of how you're advising clients today that we haven't discussed yet?
Well, you know, I've always emphasized with all of my clients, be diversified. I always focus on that starting from the starting point. So let me give you an example of a client that I thought I had really well diversified, and they reached retirement age. They decided to retire about 2 years ago, and they said, David, I want to put my money in something super, super safe. And
did you say a savings account or a mattress?
Well, I said I could definitely dial down your portfolio where we, you know, we're still keeping up with the cost of living, keeping up in, with inflation. And they said, no, David, I'm going to move my money up from you, and I'm going to put my money all in gold because I'm getting ready to retire, and I want to be as safe as possible. Well, my point with that is over the last 2 years, gold has gone down about 25%. This client's whole purpose in making the change, and I don't know if she got it from watching TV, some commercial, or some really smart guy that was telling her in the back of her head, no, gold is the only safe place to invest your money. But she lost 25% over the last 2 years trying to be safe. So when I was trying to have my conversation with her, I was saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Be diversified.
Because everything is susceptible to the market.
There's some risk in everything that you invest in.
Do you think the appeal of gold for some people is that it's tangible, that there's this sense that there's like a physical object that you can see and that it's not going to evaporate into thin air? The object itself, not the value of it, can still fluctuate.
Yeah, gold is a really interesting asset because it's kind of this mystical value that gets associated with it sometimes in the investment community. But I would argue that, you know, if you're buying it because it's a tangible asset, all it is a pile of effectively rocks. It doesn't really have much value from a physical value. So I know it's tangible, but at the end of the day, what you're looking at is what's the value of that going to be in the future when I want to convert that into an income stream or an asset that I can use to go buy groceries or take a trip to Europe. Gold is an asset. It goes up and down based on demand, just like all their assets.
Well, David Jackson was just telling a story of one of his clients, and we'd love to get your story, too, before our time is up. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to share it. That number again, 816-235-2888. Alex, what about you? Do you have any client stories that will shed light on how people are feeling right now?
Well, one of the things that yes, but before that, all-time highs. We keep hearing that, all-time highs. And that's what we do try when clients come in is to put that into some perspective. What does that mean? And for the S&P 500, which is, you know, the kind of the benchmark in America, it took 14 years of backfilling from 2000 to now to make new all-time highs. So when you put it in perspective and adjusted for inflation, we're barely above where we were in 2000. So you hear all-time high, but yeah, all-time high that was made basically in 2000. So in historical perspective, we're not like on a bubble at this point, which we talked about what happens to a bubble.
Yeah. You know?
So and that's what we try to show is these long charts for clients to understand where we are in the process, you know, historically, and what are we really talking about highs? And then secondly, how does that relate to their portfolio? And by and large, I think after 2008 and 2009, clients did become more conservative. It's a natural tendency to be conservative. In retrospect, it was the worst time to be more conservative. That's when we should have opened a little more aggressiveness because prices were very cheap. But we never know what's going to happen, so you do have to have some perspective on what risk you'll entertain and what is good for yourself long-term emotionally.
So what about that story you were going to tell us?
Well, I had two clients. One is an uncle, and God love him. He's passed. And then one was a client that probably should have never hired because he was always – so both of them, almost to the day got out at the market low in 09. My uncle said that we'll never make money in this market going forward because of the new president. And he had his biases. Turned out to be wrong. We're up 150%, you know. And then this other person who always got it wrong, and so he left, and he wasn't very happy, but I felt bad because he left at the wrong time. And so when fear is the greatest, that's probably a time to sit, not move. It's too late.
You know, something that, speaking of fear being at its greatest, something that I was observing last week was Wall Street Journal live blogging a day in the markets, just what was happening, who was saying what the shifts were on a minute-by-minute way. We were talking about long-range view. This was a minute-by-minute ups and downs kind of thing. Something like with the 24-hour news cycle and the ability of the internet and live blogging to capture momentary change, how do you think that that's affecting people's psyches around this stuff?
It continues to get people excited and get on the emotional roller coaster. And I really advise my clients in times of volatility to turn the news off, stop going to the financial websites and reading and just consuming it, because it gets it really plays with your emotions. And again, minute by minute, second by second, doesn't matter. It's all white noise in the long run. But what it can do is it can cause you to make irreversible, permanently bad decisions. So the guy that sells out in March of 2009, sells out at the very bottom, misses all the upside. You know, that's a permanent decision that you've lost capital permanently. You never had a chance to recover that. So that's where it comes down to emotions you have to be kind of self-aware and understand how that's impacting you and not let that encourage you to make a bad decision based on things that do not matter right now and do not matter for your long-term perspective.
We're here in a newsroom, and I guess I wonder if there is a way to cover in the news responsibly these kinds of shifts that, you know, none of us have a crystal ball mm-hmm. with the future in it, to know what is important to share with people and what is, as you say, just white noise.
Well, no, you think about NPR being a nonprofit versus the other stations that are for profit. And so when you're for profit, you got to do whatever you can to get the ratings up. And, you know, like they say in the newspaper business, if it bleeds, it leads. You know, the press can't help but get hype up stuff that's going on to get more viewership or whatever. And so it is kind of it's detrimental to the average investor, because, like I said, when they see stuff happening, when they hear stuff happening, they feel, okay, I need to react. Something's going on. I need to react. And usually the best decision is not to react. But I don't know if there's a way to get that out of the news business, because they're in a business to get more viewers.
Well, and the other thing I think that the media gets a bad rap for, I think they're communicating the information, but it's how the person receives it and internalizes it, right? It's a choice to turn the channel or turn it off. It's also a choice to hear it and make a decision, or hear it and not make a decision. So, you know, you can make the media the bad guy all you want, but really it's a matter of personal choice to determine how you consume it, or if you consume it at all.
Let's get some of our callers who have a couple of questions for us now. We've got Anita in Midtown. Hi, Anita.
Hi. I was wondering your opinion on placing your money in I-bonds.
You know, I think that's a great question. So what you're looking at is a bond that has an interest rate that's gets adjusted for inflation. I think that definitely can be a part of a portfolio. I probably wouldn't recommend it for an entire portfolio. But I think if you're expecting higher inflation coming down the pike, that would be one option to potentially include.
Do you think people do spend a lot of time trying to predict the course of inflation? And do you think that affects a lot of investment decisions? Or do you think that isn't where most people are getting their cues?
I think it's an important factor in investment decisions. Interest rates, like many other things, or inflation rates, are notoriously hard or impossible to predict. So, I think you can look at it and have that be an input. It shouldn't drive your whole strategy.
Inflation definitely affects markets. Generally speaking, though, when inflation starts to pick up, stocks do very well. It's on the tail end of the high inflation where stocks suffer. But, boy, people make huge bets on which way inflation's going. And recently, been really wrong because inflation stayed low.
Let's talk to Paul in Lawrence. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I've had a sketchy experience with money managers and lost quite a bit of money in 2000. But the consensus seems to be, with the material that I'm getting, is that there's possibly a good correction even coming beyond what we've experienced. Is it make sense to have any of your funds to hedge for that occasion, to have something in a short position?
Okay, who wants to take that one?
Of course, you know, if you're right, then that's a bet. You know, I always try to ask to talk to people of that long term. You know, the world's population is growing, and businesses pass along their inflation rates. So the only way long term, if you're a long term investor, not a trader or a speculator, you got to own something, land, a business, somebody else's business, like IBM, Apple, Google, or whatever. So if you keep that long term perspective, owning something gives you a hedge against purchasing power risk. And it's a reality. And so Paul's question is about, I think, more of a short-term trading. And I'm not good about speculating, so I try to keep people focused on solving long-term problems with long-term solutions.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking at the beginning of the year, I remember hearing an investment professional speaking about he expected the market to end up the year up about 10%. But he also expected there to be a 10% or so correction sometime during the year. So which are you more concerned about, the 10% correction sometime during the year or ending up the year 10% up? You know, and so if you get too hung up on when is this correction coming, how do I position myself to avoid this correction and end up missing out on having a 10% gain for the year, I think you lose sight of what's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll ditto what David said. And then I think the one of the most important things that a lot of investors tend to forget is time horizon with your money. So if you need the money in the next couple of years, you shouldn't be investing in risky assets. That would include stocks.
What should you be doing?
You should be keeping it in stable investments like cash, money markets, CDs, or very short-term bonds that aren't going to give you a lot of fluctuation when interest rates change. So those aren't really attractive rates right now, but that's what you should have it if you're going to need that money in 6 months or a year to meet your expenses. Once you can go kind of beyond that 2 to 3 year time frame, then you've got the ability to ride out ups and downs in the market. And you know, it's really hard to predict what's coming down the pike, when the next correction is going to be, when the next event that we can't predict is going to come down the pike. And so if you've got your short-term money in the appropriate place, you can take risk and ride the ups and downs in the long-term money. And over the long term, you should come out just fine.
How do you discipline yourself to not see a loss as like, okay, that could have been a car, and now it's nothing?
That's a great question. And you know, it's paper money in that, you know, it's changes in numbers on a statement. And so
that's all it is.
If you needed that money to buy a car this year or next year, you should have had it in something other than stocks. But if not, just know that now might be an opportunity to buy shares at a cheaper price, and you might be able to have two cars later.
You know, Alex, earlier you mentioned that when you look at inflation that and you look at, I don't know, the long term, that the only thing that you can really hedge against is owning something. That owning something provides a certain degree of security. It sounds a little bit like the mindset before the recession about real estate being sort of a surefire kind of investment. What do you say to people who maybe I don't know, the real estate market did kind of
go
wonky?
Yeah, no question. If you look historical, I mean, that's all we have to judge anything on is the past of how you treat me or how the markets have performed. So historically, real estate was not that great of investment when you consider, you know, all the money you put into it. But we had that bubble with real estate, and people got on late, many people. And so I think real estate is a great investment for ownership and pride of ownership. And the emotional nature of that, it is not a great – this is residential real estate. Traditionally, has not been a really great long-term investment. People say I put in $50,000, now worth, you know, it's 100 or whatever. But, you know, that was over a long period of time, and
right.
You were buying it over a long period of time, putting money back in it with some slight tax help. But real estate had its own bubble. I don't think we're going to see that probably for a while. And we encourage people to think of real estate as something that benefits their lifestyle, not their retirement.
What about this idea? What are some other things you can own that do provide some kind of, some concrete association with your money that would be also an investment? Is there such a thing now, or now that the real estate bubble has burst, that's an old-fashioned idea?
Well, corporate real estate, you know, owning home, you know, rental homes, owning a building where you lease, you know, owning raw land, farmland has been good. But I think the guys here are real, and I haven't said it yet, but diversification. You got to spread your money around in that, in terms of what you own it and where you loan it. My father used to always have this one accent. He'd always say, the real money is made owning the bank, not loaning your money to the bank.
Good point.
Who else has a story here that will really shed light on maybe what the investor mentality is right now?
You know, that's a great question. So I have had a client recently that called in and has been really concerned about the international markets. And I think lots of bad news coming out of Europe. There's concerns about the growth over there, deflation. That's a kind of a negative word that nobody seems to understand. A lot of concern is, should we make a change? Should we sell out and do something different with it? And the options are, should we do something different and buy something that probably looks more expensive? My comment was, we probably ought to be buying more of European stocks because they're down, the valuations are down, and that's the way you make money long term, is buy assets low and look for them to appreciate over time.
That's all the time we have for today's conversation, but you can listen back to this money therapy discussion later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. Lucas Butchell, thank you for your time. And David Jackson, it's been a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Alex Petrovic, thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you, Gina.
I will remember to own the bank next time. Tomorrow, we'll talk about what makes Alvin Ailey's choreography distinctive and how that style and presence has affected the overall dance landscape in Kansas City, plus how Royals fans are living out of town and experiencing this moment from afar. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. The Standard's been set. Stick around for Up to Date next.